Good morning, everyone, and welcome once again to the Parsha Shiur. Back after a little bit of a hiatus of no Parsha Shiur, and then we'd taken the month before to talk about Megillat Rut. So we are finally back to talking about the Parsha Shiurim. And the truth is, I was thinking about this last night, how the Parsha Shiurim have kind of, I didn't necessarily set out with a, this is what I'm trying to do with them. But what I've always found myself gravitating towards is rather than trying to do some sort of large overview of the Parsha, or make perhaps some grand claim about a theme, even though sometimes we've done that, what I really, really find myself gravitating to when I'm learning through the Parsha with the intent to give a shiur is, let's take a small, usually well-known piece of the narrative, and by reading it a little more carefully, recognize that it's not what we think. That the way we typically, traditionally, instinctively read a given story is not actually how that story progresses. And what I want to talk about today, and as I titled the Sorshi, as you can see, they weren't spies. And what I mean by that is that when we take a closer look at a whole host of different aspects to the people we refer to as the Meraglim. Meraglim literally, it really means spies. We refer to the Meraglim, we talk about the Chet HaMeraglim, the sin of the spies. But if there is anything that is there are few words that seem to capture less what these people do, then referring to them as Meraglim, as spies. And the truth is that I think part of the temptation to consider them spies, but also the very clear proof that they aren't spies, comes from the Haftarah. So the Haftarah we will read after Parashat Shalach this week comes from the second chapter of Sefer Yehoshua, the book of Joshua, which is a story of spies. If you take a look at the very first source on the source sheet, you'll see it's the very first verse of chapter 2 of Sefer Yehoshua. Vayishlach Yehoshua ben Nun min Hashitim, that Yehoshua ben Nun sends from the location of Shittim, Shnayim Anashim Meraglim Cheresh, two secret spies. Meraglim does mean spies, but it means kind of, the more literal word is kind of move around. Cheresh is silence. It's people who move around in silence. These are spies. That is, you know, textbook definition of a spy, someone who sneaks around. Lots of, you know, thieves also sneak around, but you get the idea. Sneaking around, observing things, these are the spies. Lemor saying, L'chu, re'u et ha'aretz ve'et yericho. So the English translation here even uses the word reconnoiter. Like, this is a reconnaissance mission, but go see, look, you know, look at the land, and specifically the Yericho. Vayelechu vayavo beit isha zona ushma Rachav vayishkavu shama. And they go and they go to the lodging of Rachav. Again, it's important to note here, where do you go if you don't want anyone to ask you your name? Where do you go if you don't want, you know, anyone to be in any way asking questions about where you come from? You go to a brothel. They're not going to ask, oh, you know, names, addresses, please. It's instinctively a place of anonymity. That's where these spies, they are Meraglim Cheresh, silent creepers, sneakers, spies. That is the definition of what they are. It's very clear, as we see from the source sheet, which again, if you click at the link that's in the chat, you can view the source sheet. Fascinatingly, nowhere is that word used in the story in Parashat Shlach. Never once are they referred to as Meraglim. The key word, if you look at the second source, verse 2 of chapter 13 of Sefer Bamidbar, Shelach lecha anashim, send agents is an English word that's already kind of biasing, the anashim, people, viaturu et eretz Canaan, and they'll wander around, they'll scout, they'll go on a walk. Viaturu has none of the connotations of secrecy. It doesn't imply, it's not Meraglim Cheresh, it's not silent sneaking, it's not spying. It's kind of, you know, Viaturu is kind of, you're taking a wander around, you know, anywhere. You know, sometimes if you're ever Maybe this is just something we do, but I don't think it's true. Sometimes you just take a drive, you know. Let's go explore the area a little bit. You want to explore? You're not casing the joint when you're exploring the area. You're simply, let's see what's around. You know, we've been living here. We want to know what, we've always wondered what's in that direction. Viaturu, that word, that's really what it connotes. Let's go see what's over there. It has zero connotations of spying, save the fact that it's the word used in this story, and we tend to associate the story as being one of spying, but Viaturu is not spying. If you also notice a couple of other things from, again, the very first source, the first verse of the second chapter of Yehoshua, our Haftarah, these spies are anonymous. We don't know their names. There's only two of them. We're talking about a small elite force. They are commissioned by Yehoshua, the leader of the people, brings two people into his tent whom he knows are going to be good at this. And he's like, you two, you go. Again, you're spying the land. Tell me what's going on. In contrast, if we read the rest of the second source in Parashat Shlach. So again, verse 2 begins, Shlach lecha Hashem, you know, send men. V'yaturu et Eretz Kanaan, asher ani notein lebnei Yisrael. I want them to explore the land of Israel that I'm giving the Jewish people. Ish echad l'matei avotav tishlachu. Send one person from each tribe. Kol nosivahem, each one of them a prince. We're going to assume there is much debate over what exactly this term nasi means, but the traditional translation, and we're not gonna have reason to challenge that today. The traditional interpretation means these are actually the nasiim, the political leaders, the chieftains of the tribe. And, you know, we continue to read, Vayishlach otam Moshe midbar paran al-pi Hashem, kulam anashim, rashei v'nei Yisrael hema. They were all the leaders of the Jewish people. And then I just gave you verse 4, but the next few verses, name them all. Ve'ela shmotam, these were their names. L'matei Reuven, the representative of Reuven was Shamua ben Zakor. That several questions already jumped to mind. If this is a spy, a reconnaissance mission, if these are really spies, several questions jump out. First of all, the choice of 12 tribes is more a PR exercise. When you are looking for an elite tribe, you're not going for a cross spectrum of the community. You're not trying to be inclusive. Like there are many areas where inclusivity is good, and there's a difference between creating barriers to certain people. But generally speaking, if you're trying to select an elite group of people who are going to go on a very intense reconnaissance mission, you're not like, we need one of everything. That's not how you do it. You pick the best people. You know what you also don't do when you're forming an elite group of people? So first of all, you don't make it 12, which is a pretty large number. You also don't choose the political elite. You know, this is the classic question I don't really want to answer, other than to just raise it to further challenge this point that these are spies. If you are choosing a secret elite force, you're not sending your political elite into unknown, dangerous territory. That's not, you know, you don't, you know, it's that fate, you know, for people who may remember, I assume it made the US news, but when it emerged that Prince Harry, the Queen's grandson, was actually serving in either Afghanistan or Iraq, they had to pull him straight from the front line, because it turns out you don't send your royal family to fight wars. It's not, you don't send your Nasi'e, your Nasi'im, your tribal princes, oh, we need you to infiltrate this dangerous location and report back. That's chaos. It makes no sense. Furthermore, these people are named. We get their names. Unlike Yehoshua, where it's like, we don't get their names. We don't need to know their names. They have code names and nothing else. Here, there's a whole big song and dance about the public nature of what they are doing. Again, spies, we famously don't publicize the spy missions of people. You know, you don't get a news flash, you know, Joe so-and-so, who lives in such and such a town, age such and such, will currently be, you know, just, we want everyone to know he's going to be infiltrating somewhere to let us know what's happening. That's famously not what you do. And if you do it, you learn from your mistakes quickly. Spies are secretive. No one knows. It gets even stranger when we look at the briefs given to the respective, you know, spies in Yehoshua and spies in Shlach. So again, Yehoshua, we already read it, the first verse of chapter 2. It's simply, you know, scout the region, let us know what's happening. In contrast, the next source on the sheet begins verse 17 of chapter 13 of Sefer Bamidbar. Vayishlach otam Moshe lator et Eretz Kanaan. Moshe sent them, again that word lator, to explore the land of Canaan. Vayomer aleihem, he instructed them, saying, Aluze ba-Negev va'alitem et ha-har, go there into the Negev, into the hill country. Or item et ha-aret mahi, tell us what the land is like. Ve'et ha'am ha-yoshev aleha hechazak hu ha-rafe. Hama'at hu imrav. And we want to know kind of other people who live in it, strong or weak, few or many. That kind of makes sense as a spy brief, right? We're about to basically be an invasion force into this land. We need to know what are the people like who live there. But then it continues. Uma ha'aretz asher hu yosheba. What about the land in which they dwell? Hatovahi imra. Is it good land, bad land? Uma ha'arim asher hu yosheb bahena. Hab machanim im b'mivtzarim. Do they live open or fortified? Okay, again, somewhat useful information. Uma ha'aretz hashmena hi imraza hayeshba eitz im ayin. But is the wood good? Is it wooded or not? V'hit chazaktem ulkachtem mipri ha'aretz. Please, you know, make sure you bring back some of the fruit of the land. V'hayamim yemei bikoreinavim. It happened to be the season of grapes. That is not how spy missions work. If you are planning, like Yehoshua, right? Go in, get out, tell me the strength. Not, and while you're there, can you pick up a couple of things over here? Just also like a little soil sample. Just by the way, was it sunny at the time you went there? Like these things don't, and it's also important to bear in mind, the Jewish people are moving into that land regardless. Quite frankly, if they were to turn back and be like, soil's terrible, the weather was miserable, it's not going to change the fact that that is the land. So as a spy mission, the only thing that you know, the military strength of the people makes sense, but some of these other aspects, bring back some fruit. That is not a reconnaissance mission. That is not a spy mission. That's a vacation. Like, what is happening? What is going on? Furthermore, we have to recognize and if you take a look at the next source, which is verse 23 from Sefer Bamidbar, Vayavo ad Nachal Eshkol, they reached the Wadi Eshkol. Vayichritu Misham Zmora Eshkol Anavim Echad, they cut down a branch with a single cluster of grapes. Vayisa'ehu Vamot Bishnayim, they had to, two people it took to carry them, Umin Harimonim, Umin Hatinim, and they also bring pomegranates and figs. So now remember that the whole image here is of a very large bounty. So if these people were spies sneaking around the land, and the previous verse tells us about how they go near the city of the giants. So maybe again, imagine this is a small force of spies not qualified to do the job, but they've made it this far. They've snuck past the land of the giants. What are they doing on their way back? Carrying giant things of grapes. That is not how one is secretive. It slows them down. They're going to be spotted. It's very visible. Again, it's not something that fits with the brief of spies. Contrast with the description again in chapter 2 of Yehoshua, which is far more classic spying. This is the opposite. It does not make, again, sense if we conceive of them as spies. And things only get even more ridiculous when we consider the conclusion of each mission. How does the story in Yehoshua conclude? Verse 23 of chapter 2 of Yehoshua on the source sheet. Vayashuvu shnei ha'anashim, the two men return. Vayerdu min ha'har, they come down from the mountain. Vayavru vayavo el Yehoshua ben Nun. They come to Yehoshua and Yehoshua alone. Vaysapru lo et kol hamotzaot otam, and they report to him all that had happened to them. Yehoshua commissioned an elite task force, and they report solely to him. That is how spying works. The fewer people who know, the better. They report directly to the person who sent them out, and they give the exact details, and that's it. It's a military reconnaissance mission. They learn information. They provide that information back to Yehoshua. In contrast, let's read. So imagine until now, you remain unconvinced that this is not a spy mission in Parashat Shalat, and you are determined to think of spy missions. And again, you've seen enough spy movies to have admittedly not a spy. Spy movies probably not a good, accurate representation of the spying life. But that being said, again, given how little we otherwise know about spying, and if you've ever read any books about, real spies, secrecy tends to be the number one requirement of any spy. Now let's read the conclusion of this part of the Meraglim, the spy story in Parashat Shlach, beginning verse 25 of chapter 13 of Sefer Bamidbar on the source sheet. Vayashuvu mitor haaretz miketz arbar miyom. They came back. Again, note that word, mitor, from exploring the land after 40 days. Vayelechu vayavo el Moshe v'al Aaron. They went straight to Moshe and Aharon. Okay, leaders. Ve'el kol adat b'nei Yisrael, and the entire people, el midbar param kadesha, at Kadesh. Vayashivu otam davar ve'et kol ha'eda. They made their report to them, Moshe and Aaron, and the entire people. Vayarom et priyat, and they showed them the fruit of the land. That is not what spies do. Again, newsflash, press conference. We just had this guy secretly exploring Iran. But now what they're going to do is give a press conference to the entire nation about what they discovered. That's not how spying works. You don't get 12 people from one from each tribe in order to maximize representation who happen to be the tribal leaders of each and every tribe to go on this exploration mission to bring back fruit and general reporting on basically how nice a time they had, and then have them come back and report that publicly to the entire people. Like, imagine, think about the story of Parashat Shlach, and imagine if Moshe and Aaron would be like, why don't you give us a rundown of what you're going to say first? Right? Everything would have been different. It's like there's some sort of classic leadership lesson in there. But now they go straight to the whole exercise is not for them to tell Moshe and Aaron first, but to just go straight to the people, the banners out, welcome back, the people from their exploratory trip. What on earth is going on? So Yonatan Grossman, who is, I've quoted him before, one of my favorite people when it comes to just really brilliant, insightful, subtle reads of Tanakh, where again, he always kind of does this kind of thing. This makes no sense. This is why. But it's not that the alternative solution is always this like out of the box idea. It's always this far more sensible understanding of the narrative. Yonatan Grossman points out, the whole exercise here was not reconnaissance. Unlike Yehoshua, who was going for a military reconnaissance mission, the Meraglim, the spies, are not there to spy. The entire thing is a giant PR exercise on behalf of Moshe and Aharon. And the clue to this is to recognize where we are in the Torah. So just last week, the final source on the sheet is from beginning verse 4 of chapter 11 of Sefer Bamidbar. We read this last week. V'hasafsuf asher b'kirba, the riffraff. Riffraff, I feel like I could be wrong here, but riffraff is one of those like, it's not onomatopoeic, that's the wrong, because the sound, onomatopoeia is the sound is something like what it represents. But like, there must be some word for like, riffraff has a certain sound quality to which kind of conjures what the word means. And, you know, the Hasaf Suf kind of has that same, very similar sound, actually, which is interesting, but I could just be completely wrong. The Hasaf, not a crucial point to the entire share, so I could be very wrong on this, and it changes nothing, but nonetheless, the Hasaf Suf, the Rifra, Asher Bikabot, in the midst of the Jewish people, Hit Avu Ta'ava, they felt a gluttonous craving. Vayashuvu vayivku gam b'nei Yisrael, and then the Jewish people also weep, and they say, vayomru mi'a alichenu basar, who will feed us meat? They're in the wilderness, they have no meat. Zacharnu et hadaga, we remember the fish, asher nochal b'mitzrayim chinam, that we would eat for free in Egypt. Et hakishu'im, the cucumbers, ve'et ha'avatachim, the melons, ve'et hechotzir, the leeks, ve'et habsalim, the onions, ve'et hashum. In the garlic. We're starving. We have nothing to eat. Except for this man, which basically we're starting to get sick of. The Jewish people, and it's this tremendous act of gall, but they're basically like, you know what was good about slaves, being slaves? Food supply was dependable. Now, admittedly, it's hard to, and this is why this originally comes from the Hasaf Suf, and it's always interesting to know who are these people. The kind of traditional interpretation is these are kind of Egyptians who then fled with the Jewish people. So it would make sense that the Egyptians have given up a glorious life for hardship joining the Jewish people. It's unlikely, really, the Jewish people would have had particular delicacies. But nonetheless, the point is they would probably have had maybe slightly more variety of diet. It's hard to imagine, but the point is the Jewish people, Sefer Bamidbar is the Jewish people kind of complaining a lot. The original enthusiasm and excitement of slavery, of leaving slavery into freedom is kind of worn off. And now they're starting to notice, and this is obviously before anything, before Parashat Shlach is definitionally before they are condemned to wander the desert for 40 years. But even still, they've been at it for a year and they're starting to be like, everything's a little samey in the wilderness. Everything's a little bit too much routine, and maybe we're getting a little bit sick of it, and they start to complain over and over again to Moshe. The Jewish people start to complain. Moshe has recognized and realized that the morale among the people is low. And so he recognizes a need to do something different. The Jewish people are on the march to the land of Israel. And the point is, it's that classic, you know what, it's really tough now, but let me tell you what things are gonna be like. So what does he do? He decides to assemble a group of people. So Lavi asks, they had plenty of livestock, there was no shortage of meat. So meat eating in the wilderness is a very complicated discussion. Because they weren't eating it. They were eating the man. That's the kind of the short answer. Why they weren't eating it. Basically, what we call, there is technically, or at least there existed in the times of the Torah, for reasons that are actually pretty simple reasons, I just don't want to get into it, because the entire topic is a little bit not fresh in my mind. But there is a prohibition in the times of the Torah of eating basar ta'ava, of eating meat purely for the desire of eating. You can eat meat as part of bringing a sacrifice, but the idea of eating meat wantonly was not something they did. So yeah, you make a good point, but they weren't eating the meat particularly. And the more point is their main source of subsistence, so their main source of food is the man, and they're sick of it. The other point that's probably another answer to this, Lavi, is sometimes people just like to complain for complaining's sake. That's what the riffraff are doing. So it's not necessarily a rational complaint. It's like, again, this is true of all human beings in the world. There are some people who have rational complaints about things, and then there are people who have irrational complaints about things. And the irrational complaints tend to reveal a broader dissatisfaction with something. So that's what's happening here. In Parashat Bahalotcha, the riffraff just want to complain. So they complain about the glorious lives in Egypt, which don't really make sense because we know they were slaves. Again, unless we assume the riffraff weren't slaves themselves, but it's hardly a winning mentality to be like, you know, trying to remind a bunch of slaves that food was good in Egypt when it wasn't. But they just want to complain. And so what Moshe is doing is trying to restore morale. You're going to get to the land of Israel. And you know what we're going to send? We're going to send a group of people. And you know what? Each one of them is going to be from your tribe. So you have trust. You know, you recognize that this person represents your own tribal interests and affinities. And you know what? We're going to send your leader. We're going to send the most important person in your tribe, because then they will come back. And, you know, it's one thing to send Joe. No one likes Joe. But it's another thing to send Shamua ben Zakor of the tribe of Reuven. Everyone respects Shamua. He's the tribal elder. So when he comes back and he's like, that was the best 40 days of my life. You should see the grapes. Everyone's going to be like, yay, this is worth it. The whole point is a PR exercise. Moshe sends the people. He tells them, let us know how good the land is. Let us know how nice things are. Please bring back some of the food so we can see just how wonderful things are going to be. It's classic getting people excited for a trip they're a little bit hesitant to make. Let's go see all of the amazing things we're going to do. It's like, you know, kind of translated into kid about to go to camp. Here are all the fun things you're going to do in camp. Don't look. Let's look online at all the water slide, the food. That's basically what Moshe is doing with the people. The whole goal is this giant PR exercise to excite the people. Admittedly, there is a certain level of information gathering. We assume, and I don't want to get into this whole question, it's a major question about Shelach, and the somewhat conflicting accounts between Parashat Shelach and Sefer Devarim over whose idea was it. But the question is this whole mission a lack of faith in Hashem or not? What is the people's, you know, but the idea Moshe maybe just wants is basic information about the land. He believes God's going to help them conquer it. But at the end of the day, if you're going to tackle a walled city, that's going to be different to, you know, tackling open farmland. But the main exercise here is simply an exercise in PR. But this is where everything backfires, because it's a really good idea to encourage Shamua ben Zakor to go check out the land. Only if you trust and know Shamua ben Zakor is going to bring back a positive comment. Because had Joe gone from the time of Reuven, and no one likes Joe, had he come back and been like, best 40 days of my life, then it would have been like, yeah, but can we really trust Joe? But had Joe turned around and been like, miserable most of the time, you know, spent the whole time in bed sick, he'd be like, okay, but we know he's a negative Nancy anyway, so like, who cares? But it backfires because you have all of these tribal leaders turning up and being like, oh my gosh, this is going to be all, we're all going to die. We're all going to die trying to conquer this land. It sucks. And that backfires. And part of the reason I think it backfires is because Moshe chose the most qualified people for a PR exercise and the least qualified people for a reconnaissance mission. The whole core point is, if you are a tribal leader, we're assuming here, and admittedly this is an assumption, but I think the point is this assumption is borne true by the text itself. Tribal leaders are not military leaders. And so what happens is, Shamua ben Zakor has not been chosen as the tribal leader for his handiness with the sword. And now he goes and he sees the giants roaming around their cities and he's like, how are we going to chop their heads off? And so he panics and they all panic and they come back and they set panic in the people. By choosing what was supposed to be the most trusted people among the Jewish people, what actually happens is those trustworthy people only report back the wrong information, transmit their fears, transmit their concerns, and that spreads. That you know, it's an infectious spread throughout the people as everyone becomes panicked at once. And so this whole exercise backfires But crucially, it was never intended as a reconnaissance mission. The Meraglim, despite the fact that we call them the Meraglim, are anything but spies. That's not their purpose. That's not their goal. Unlike Sefer Yehoshua, our Haftarah, where the whole purpose is a spy mission. The entire thing is one giant PR exercise in order to excite the people about going to the land of Israel to boost their morale after a little bit of disappointment. But tragically, that completely backfires in Moshe's face as these tribal leaders end up only setting greater negativity into the minds of the people.